For the next podcast, I wanted to play an interview I had with Aaron and Jacob, and they run the E6S Methods podcast. So we recorded one back in 2015, just a year ago, and that was going over Lean Six Sigma and the environment. And it ended up being two different podcasts, so I'm going to combine them together and play that for you now. But I definitely encourage you to check out the E6S Methods podcast. And you can find that at E6S-Methods, methods.com, or you can look for it on iTunes. And I think Stitcher has a link there as well. Their podcast is really good. It's really good for learning about Lean and Six Sigma and going over some of the tools that you might have been trained on. But maybe you haven't had a lot of support or reinforcement of those tools. So they go through and talk on different topics and tools and give their best practices and tips from their years of experience with that. So it's really valuable as a refresher or if you're learning some of the new tools. And so they're considered a source for expert training, consulting, and leadership in business performance and continuous improvement methods such as Lean and Six Sigma. I met Aaron at the Engineering and Lean Six Sigma conference in Atlanta in 2015. We were both speaking at that conference. It was put on by the Institute for Industrial and Systems Engineers, which is IISE. And we hit it off pretty well. And so he asked me to come talk on his podcast about some of the things I've been working on with Lean Six Sigma and the environment. So check out this longer podcast from the interview we had. And hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the E6S Method Podcast with Jacob and Aaron, brought to you by E6S Industries, your source for expert training, consulting, and leadership in business performance and continuous improvement methods like Lean and Six Sigma. In this episode number 92, we speak with Lean Six Sigma practitioner and speaker Brian Hurley, who offers insights into the Lean Six Sigma applications in sustainability and environmental programs. Check out Brian's work at www.leansixsigmaenvironment.org. Here we go. Hey, Jacob, how are you?
I'm doing great, Aaron. How are you doing?
Jacob, I am doing great. Jacob, this is a very special episode. We have our first listener submission, and we have our first guest that we're jointly interviewing. His name is Brian Hurley. Brian Hurley, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So Brian submitted his idea. Brian is going to be a presenter at the Engineering Lean Six Sigma conference for 2015 that's coming up a couple weeks, huh? It was September or October 1st or 2nd?
Yep. I'm on the 2nd, I think.
You're on the 2nd, and that's going on in Atlanta, Georgia. So if anybody's in and around that time, be sure to check out Brian's topic. Brian, you're going to be talking about Lean Six Sigma tools specifically used for the environment, right?
Right. Yeah. So the topic I'm covering is how sustainability or environmental sustainability fits into your Lean Six Sigma program.
All right. So before we get into that, how about you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I started and went through college at the University of Iowa. I got a statistics bachelor's degree, and then I continued and got a master's in quality management. And then I kind of landed into a manufacturing support role with Rockwell Collins, which is an aerospace company in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And my background was statistics, so they needed someone to backfill a position there. And then over the years, I just kind of always had a support role where I was doing a lot of training. And we had a lean program at the time that just started maybe a year before I started there. And I started learning some of the lean concepts. I kind of already had a Six Sigma background.
Right.
And basically what I've been doing over the last, I've been there 16 years now. So the last few years I've been trying to integrate our Six Sigma initiative with our lean program and trying to have a nice blended approach. So I was kind of teaching myself and learning how the lean side worked and then trying to bring in the Six Sigma piece.
So, that's kind of interesting because usually the people who come into this program or the Lean Six Sigma, I think often come from engineering and start off in manufacturing. What brought you from statistics to try to go into industry?
Yeah, in school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do or how statistics would be helpful. So I felt like I kind of landed into that. And I always liked the applied side of it. I disliked the academic part of it. And so I was definitely looking for a way to utilize it in a real world setting. And the master's program I went through had a combination of industrial engineering, business management, and statistics. So it kind of set it up as this, support for businesses, basically kind of your Six Sigma program without calling it that. This is still late 90s, so it was still a pretty new concept. And so, as I got in there, I kind of realized where my skill set could fit in and then just continually kind of try to build up the employees to know what to do. Some of the real basic stuff, I mean, not even green belt level, really just kind of mean standard deviations, histograms, and control charts, and started to get into a little bit of capability, but starting really at the basics.
Right, and you'd be surprised, even though looking at it now, and especially as a statistician, you do look at that as the basics. But in some parts of manufacturing, especially, or actually any business, those are kind of
Pretty advanced.
they're cutting edge, right? To look at anything other than average for any kind of metric is pretty advanced.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. I mean, I would add, I think Brian's in the aerospace industry, which might be a little bit more sophisticated than any
Sure.
average manufacturing environments, but absolutely, you're spot on there, Aaron.
So that was my thought too, was the aerospace would be more advanced. But when you get into there, still the basic problems of not having the right data, not knowing what to do with that data, or that there's tools out there that they can look at it differently or understand how to break down the variation. I mean, some of that stuff was not just, like you would go and maybe into an automotive industry and that would be kind of common knowledge, but at least I found that that was not a well-known thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the aero. I mean, I came up through Pratt and Whitney, different type of aerospace. But the tenure of the employee was 30 plus years, and it, not a whole lot had changed when I got there from 30 years ago, and so it was really was. Really working on a lot of legacy mindset and, a very aged union environment. So all of that, and engineering environment, and a lot of the engineers had come up through the ranks, so they hadn't actually had the training and background that you probably came with as well. Did you find that to be sort of similar?
A lot of the discussions were around, I took that statistics class in college, but I haven't had a chance to use it since then, or it's been, 10, 20, 30 years since I took the class. So very rusty and just, a base knowledge there. But it was really, I felt like a lot of the training is statistics 101 refresher for a lot of the engineering team.
So, did you have the opportunity to dip your toe in industry before you finished your master's, or was it gone all the way to the end? And okay, I hope you like
Pretty much, yeah. I did not have an
it.
internship. I didn't have any kind of working experience utilizing it. So that's where I struggled a little bit with trying to get into the job market of how am I marketing myself. Luckily, they had already had a statistician on staff at the time before. So they were replacing that person, and so it was a lot easier fit. But if I had to look back and do it over, I would definitely have gone into industry and done some internships or co-ops or something like that, so that the education and the classes I'm going through make a little bit more sense. And there's a little bit more motivating, and you
Sure.
can see how it's going to apply versus the textbook example. So that took me a little while to kind of get used to it. Probably the first year I struggled just trying to figure out how, general business things work and where I fit in.
Are you still in Iowa now?
Nope, I've moved around to a couple different locations. Started in Iowa for about 5 years, then I went down to a facility in Florida near Cocoa Beach for 6 years, went back to Iowa, and now I'm in Portland. Actually, it's Wilsonville. It's outside of Portland, but I'm out here. I've been out here about 2 years now at one of the other locations.
So I think you've touched just about every climate in our nation here then.
Yep, I've gotten a good variety, definitely.
All right, so let's get into really why you want to talk about this. You got all the stats, you got all the industry. What made you want to go environment?
When I met my wife, she had a really strong background on it and had a lot of questions for her, and I started to learn a lot more things than I expected about some of the problems we have right now. And I was kind of, I would say, heading a little bit in that direction, but not nearly as much as I am now. And then I started to understand, kind of look at what are those issues that are going on, and immediately I kind of honed in that, wow, this is a perfect alignment with the Lean and Six Sigma skill set I already have. Blending the two would be very easy to do. So then just started to add a bunch of education, did a lot of research on my own, and then started to take some more formal classes. I actually went back to Iowa to get a certificate of sustainability. And that was like a 2 or 3 year program. It's kind of like a minor. And so I would do that like a class or two at a time, just during while I was working. So that was kind of a little bit more formal education I got into.
And in the education portion itself, did they make that link, or did you make the link together between your skills, and how did that light bulb go off in your head and say, wow, this really links up well?
Yeah, I think it was just the initial looking at data, and obviously you gravitate towards that with a Six Sigma background. So, looking at that information and trying to figure out, yeah, you could do a lot of different things with this. So no, it wasn't really brought out that there's business approaches that work and that they can be used to help with that. They would mention stuff like ISO 9000, and but it was like 5, 10 seconds of content on that, and then they were talking about more about solutions and more of the technical, how does the earth operate, and kind of going back to like fifth grade science class.
Earth science, yeah.
Yes, basically. So that was really helpful because a lot of that you forget, but in terms of like a process to deal with a problem at a business where they have some kind of environmental waste, how to methodically go through that and solve that problem and not just jump to a here's a list of five different things you can just do to try to improve that. What process can we have people walk through so they all kind of arrive at that same solution?
So I guess sometimes when I hear sustainability, I think for sustainability on the business side, which is also a lot of more regulatory now and also gets into social responsibility. Was there an overlap there, or do you treat environmental sustainability and call it social sustainability differently?
Yeah, no, it's all under the same umbrella. I guess the popular term is the triple bottom line. So you have this idea that the most successful businesses will last the longest if they balance out not only their profits, but also what impact they have on the planet and then how they treat their people. So if it's kind of a, I think traditional business is that you go for the lowest cost and try to cut money and make the most profits as you can, but if you aren't looking at those other two areas, then your business is at risk. Whether you're going to be more vulnerable to changes in the environment, to price increases, to regulatory things that come down the line, that the businesses that balance out those three areas the best will be in the best shape to survive in the long term. So that's kind of the overall sustainability term. That's this long-term success. But yeah, it is kind of broken up into those three pieces, and the two pieces of people and planet often are the ones that get left behind.
So there's a bit of a segue into sort of the projects you've worked on, because I'll say some of the challenges I've had in even trying to get some of these environmental related projects going has been pretty difficult, because they generally, as far as the bottom line financial benefits, they don't really rise to the top. So what have you worked on, and what challenges have you had with the financial benefits, if it, or was it necessary?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, because when you start looking at, how much water or how much electricity does one machine produce? It's sometimes pennies, and you're dealing with, a yield problem, or you got tens of thousands of dollars of material going through that process. It does get dwarfed and overlooked in the big picture. So it's helpful to take a step back and look at the aggregate at the facility level and say, yeah, individually at each of these processes, when you look at it by item, it's not a big number, but when you look at the total utility costs, there is some significant cost there. And that's the best way to start, is just look at where their most spend is. Is it in their electricity? Is it in their waste hauling? Maybe there's some hazardous material or chemicals and permitting that goes on. Wherever there's a financial impact, that's probably the best place to start, because you'll get that support naturally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the places I started with the electricity reduction project, was basically looked at the Pareto of where the electricity dollars were spent, and it pointed to one huge facility at our headquarters.
Mm.
So that was easy to make a business case when you have millions of dollars a year in electricity, that, hey, maybe there's some opportunity here. We can save a few dollars. So that one was fairly easy to get some support around. I think they're just kind of looking for someone to take the lead. I mean, it's not something you get assigned to. You kind of raise your hand and say, I think there's opportunity, and I know how I can go methodically go through this and solve it without having a solution in mind. And so that's basically what I did, and put together a charter and got buy-off on management and got a few people to help out. And we were able to make about $300,000 in savings through a setback program on our air handler system.
You are listening to E6S Methods Podcast, brought to you by E6S Industries. Join us on our website at www.e6s-methods.com. Journey through success.
Are you tired of hearing our commercials? Wouldn't you rather hear your own? Buy a one-minute spot to reach hundreds of listeners each week on Stitcher Radio and iTunes. Showcase your product, market your service, or maybe even reach out to a potential employer in a truly creative and unique way. Contact us through our website for more details, www.esuccess-methods.com. Journey through success. So if I heard you right, you weren't responsible for this. Nobody was asking for anything. And you kind of just, stuck your neck out and said, hey, I'd like to take this on. Can I have some time and some resources to do this?
Yep, pretty much. Now, they had set aside some money. The company was working on a carbon reduction initiative.
Mm.
So I linked into that and said, this is one way we can kind of make a dent in that. And so after we got that launched, then I needed some help from like the maintenance crew. And we did have a energy manager. Actually, no, that was later. So initially, we did not have anyone assigned to it. Later on, they ended up making a position to kind of look at that. I think they realized that there's enough there to continue that effort, and there's enough cost there that someone should be kind of managing that and working on some projects. So they did end up setting a position after that. But I went to the ES&H department. Mm-hmm. So I think they're a good ally for a lot of businesses with tying in lean with your environment, safety, health, and your facility group. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one key point, is to try to get your facilities, your environment, safety, and health, and your lean teams together and start talking about how you can work together on providing a methodology to help them with their, usually, at least what I've been familiar with is facilities has the electricity and utility costs.
Right.
And then environment, safety, health might have some safety things, which kind of fits under that social piece. They've got the hazardous chemicals usually. And some of the waste falls under their bucket, like the solid waste and landfill stuff.
Yeah. So, any recycling of coolant and all that, and all that kind of cutting fluids. Yep.
Yep. Air emissions go through, use the ES&H and a permit of some sort. So I think if you're at a company and you've got those groups and you're not working together and you're not pulling them into events that you have, or you're not helping them with their own events, I think that'd be a great place to start. just to kind of get the, you know, alignment right there. Because those three groups can really do a lot of good work on the sustainability side of it.
Yeah, and in a big company like that, at least at Pratt & Whitney, they didn't require a lot of business case development for a program like that. You just kind of, it was justified because from top down they said, well, actually it was justified because, hey, a few years ago we got cited by the EPA and we really need to have this really, really strong program. So whatever you guys can do to make this better, you got our full backing. Was it similar there or is it more proactive?
I think it was a little more proactive. I don't think there was anything, any pressure like that coming down, at least at this facility. But yeah, definitely that's a lot of motivation for some companies, is that they've got that fine, or they've got the potential for that fine, or a lot of pressure. And, you know, this methodology, you know, going through a Lean and Six Sigma methodology and running an event really looks favorable, especially if you come out with really strong results on it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to ask, I mean, the one challenge, you know, Aaron and I both came from a chemical manufacturing world. That's how we met each other. But in our world, if I recollect right, Aaron, you know, there were definitely areas, or, you know, with the EHS team, with our corporate or the quality assurance team, who was basically trying to make sure our certifications of all the different ISO levels that we had, there were all the opportunities for these. But I never once ever saw anybody bring the conversation up, you know, we need to definitely tackle or find something to improve our, you know, environmental or our overall energy efficiency or anything like that. I think they might have come, but there was not necessarily an avenue for somebody to prioritize it and make it a key or sort of an initiative or a program. So my question was going to be, did you, besides you, Brian, was there anybody else who was actively interested or actively supporting this cause that kind of in the senior leadership team or somewhere in the organization that got them to rally behind you or your thoughts, or was it just a normal progression?
So there was I wouldn't say the senior leadership. I mean, the company has a corporate responsibility report they publish every year. They have initiatives going on. They have got some LEED certified buildings. You know, I think they do a lot of good stuff. But it was really the champion was someone in the ES&H department. She was a manager, and she was responsible for publishing the corporate report that goes out. It's a carbon disclosure project, which a lot of companies sign up and say, this is our carbon footprint, and this is what we're going to do to improve on it. And it's a international thing that gets published. And then if you don't meet those goals, there's a lot of pressure to understand why didn't you do that. And a lot of customers are driving other companies to do that. So it's a voluntary effort. So that was really the biggest motivator behind that, is we signed up for a 15% goal to reduce our carbon. And this was one of the projects that I could link into and say, this is one of the things we can do to help reduce that. So that got support, but there wasn't necessarily like an executive or senior leader that was saying, we need to cut our energy down, or we need to reduce our chemical usage, or reduce the number of amount of money we're spending on permits or wastewater treatment or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jacob, you did a wastewater treatment project once, right?
Yes, or attempted.
That's a sort of, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the motivation behind that was, again, not necessarily environmental conscious. It was more of the cost conscious, where we wanted to find our wastewater treatment was backing significantly every so often, and we were just not able to handle the volume of production to make that more efficient and make that more smooth was the main motivation behind it. And then the amount of time being spent in that process, how to find ways to make it more efficient, the driving motivation factor behind that.
So it was affecting capacity, really, operations.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So that's a good point.
That was a driver.
If you were to start off and you're in a company and you don't really have even a Lean or Six Sigma program, there's a lot of benefits you're going to get just by applying those concepts to the environment just by default. I mean, every form of waste comes with it some kind of environmental impact as well. I mean, if you've got inventory, you've got to store that somewhere, and you got to buy shelves, and you have to heat and cool that area, and you got to keep it packaged up so it doesn't corrode or wear out or get damaged. And so, you know, if you can cut down your inventory and you can reduce defects and you can reduce overprocessing so you don't have as much overtime and people aren't staying late and leaving lights on and heating and cooling, and each of those wastes comes with some kind of environmental impact. So if you can do nothing but just lean out your processes and make it more efficient, you're going to, by default, without even trying, get some environmental gains right there. So that's another, you know, benefit. I've had, we just got done with a lean event here where we relayed out the area. And one of the benefits that we weren't intending to get was we got rid of a bunch of carts that we move our product around on, mm-hmm. because it was cluttered and there was really not a lot of organization around it. So we made parking spots for each of the carts. And when we got done, we mm-hmm. were, you know, 20, 30 carts fewer than we needed. And they're going to have to replace those for ESD purposes. But now the order just got dropped by 20 or 30 carts because we don't need them anymore because we leaned out the process. And by default, we just saved on a bunch of material and like $10,000 worth of spend on that, on those carts. So that's kind of the nice thing too, is you don't really have to be focused on the environment. You're still going to help out just by doing good Lean Six Sigma projects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was probably going to add to that. I think the point which Brian you're making is, you know, people might just not be recognizing that they're doing things to make it more effective or make it more social and environmental conscious.
Yeah.
It's just maybe taking that extra step back and evaluating it. And I completely agree. I mean, Aaron, until you pointed out that we did a wastewater treatment plant project, I would have never thought about it because I did not associate that with an environmentally conscious sort of an effort. But I'm sure if now that I think about it, I could probably quantify what improvements we made as a result.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a lot of companies just aren't capturing that benefit. So they're already doing great stuff. They're just not showing that there is a gain there.
Yeah, they're not associating it with that particular reason. I mean, I think it comes down to the fact that the motivation behind doing some of this is a different reason, and as a result, they're just not looking in this direction for any impact.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I think that's the best approach. Is it's got to tie in somewhere to the business. I mean, if you're trying to do a project in an area where it's not the core business, it's, you know, I would have loved to put solar panels on the roof, but unless I can connect it to new technology we're going to use or something that's going to somewhat tie into what the company does, it's a much harder sell. Whereas if you can link it into cost or capacity concerns or storage and floor space, you know, the common metrics that most managers are going to be looking for, if you can link it into that, that's going to make it so much easier to get those types of projects done. If it's so far off in left field, it just looks like a one-off, hey, we're just going to do this for the environment, and oh, by the way, then we're going to go run our business. And you really want it to become just a blended thing where this is part of how we make decisions, and maybe it's just more motivation for why we should do the business improvement, because now I'm capturing that, hey, we're not only am I saving 5 minutes off this assembly line, but it's we also got rid of waste that was 25 minutes of processing and paperwork that we're dealing with all the hazardous material. And so not even seeing those as capturing that time or that extra labor that goes into that business case. I think that's what you're talking about here, not only just the savings, but the reason why we need to do the lean improvement or justify it.
So I can see a lot of these sort of programs, in order to have a benefit, you'd have to really tie the line, make the connections between several business units because, you know, say energy savings, a lot of that just falls into an overhead bucket or any kind of utilities that is absorbed by the entire plant. How does that all come about where you'd have to say, hey, I'm only going to save this guy, you know, $50 a month, but I'll save the entire plant, you know, $1,000 a month. You ever had that situation?
Yeah, that's, you know, especially if you start looking at how departments and how the costing of the product is done and how those overhead costs are allocated, that can really kind of play against it, where you say, well, you're going to get this much in your budget for electricity based on your headcount or your floor space. Mm-hmm. And it's rarely, at least in my experience, not many places seem to have it nailed down to say, this is your footprint and this is your piece of the electricity bill. And that's because you have three really energy hog equipment running in here. And the group mm-hmm. next to you has a completely different electricity, you know, allocation for their budget because they don't have that same equipment. Usually it's a blanketed thing across the board. And that does make it very hard for, you know, if I'm in one part of the building and I want to make an upgrade, I don't get all the benefits of it. So I spent it out of my budget, but I didn't get all the full benefits of it. So now right. you have to go explain to your manager why you spent $10,000 and you only got $500 back in return. So it does make it harder to try to show those benefits when you can't isolate it to the specific piece of equipment or at least in a certain area.
Yeah, one. It wasn't really a project, but it was one aha moment in when I was doing EH&S at Pratt & Whitney. The entire plant was shut down, and all of the water meters, the brand new water meters they put in, said, "You just use 100,000 gallons of water last weekend." And they said, "How could we have done that? We weren't even here. Nobody was using anything." A little bit of an investigation, then they found that for their waste treatment sump pumps, there's two spigots of water constantly running at, say, 2 gallons a minute just to keep those wastewater pumps primed all the time. And that's just like one of those simple things to say, okay, do we need to keep that primed all the time? Because it's not pumping. It's not pumping right now. So, yeah, it's a shame when you see that kind of thing because we're talking 3 days, hundreds of thousands of gallons of water, of fresh water that went directly down the sewer. It's insane.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that these things, you made the connection, but you also mentioned that Lean Six Sigma, at least the tools and the methodology, may not be straightforward applied. Yeah. How did you make that happen?
So what I found a lot of useful resources was on the EPA website. They have mm-hmm. actually put a lot of time and effort into making toolkits for how does a business use Lean and Six Sigma to reduce their impact. So that was really helpful. They have toolkits on energy reduction and water, chemicals, and a lot of case studies as well. So that's a really good resource I would recommend to listeners, that epa.gov/lean. And there'll be a lot of good resources out there and examples you can look at. But so some of the things that they recommended were like modifications to some of the tools, like the value stream map. One of mm-hmm. the ideas was just adding in some of these metrics into the data boxes so that you're bringing them to light and at least making people aware of what's going on there, whether it's the total amount of usage or the efficiency of the water or chemical or how many kilowatt hours you're using, but actually putting some environmental metrics into the data box.
Right.
That was one good suggestion. And then another one I saw was they actually changed, instead of using the timeline on the bottom, they actually replaced it and put the actual amount of material that was being used. So this one that I saw was like a water value stream map. And so mm-hmm. it had how many gallons of water went into the process and how much was used. And then you could kind of see a yield or efficiency of the water being used. And then you could see, well, here's where we're losing a lot. Maybe there's some leaks or some something going on in that area that we need to focus and dig into.
Is there a way you could supply me with an example, a picture of that sort of value stream map?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I can post it for listeners.
Yeah, and I can give you the links to those different toolkits.
Excellent. All right, what else? I see you have an acronym. I love acronyms here, but you have an acronym for WASTE. So
yes.
What's that all about?
Yeah, that was I took a class at through Purdue University. It was part of their technical assistance program, and they had partnered with the Society of Manufacturing Engineers and came up with a green manufacturing specialist certificate. So I went through a couple days of training there. That was part of that education period I was going through. Mm-hmm. And that was really good. And they had this acronym called WASTE, and it stands for water, air, solids, toxins, and energy. And so it helps me kind of think about the different areas. So if I'm having a discussion with someone in the ES&H group, I can kind of, in my head, walk through those five acronyms and say, do we have air permitting issues? Do we have, what is our baseline, or what kind of spend do we have with pickup hauling charges for our trash? What is our electricity usage been? How much are we spending a month on natural gas? Those types of questions makes it easier when I think about the WASTE acronym.
Okay, so they remind you to ask about these certain things. How do those sort of interplay with the traditional Toyota WASTE, or do they?
You know, I would actually think of those as kind of like some of the metrics or some of the categories for what would be considered environmental opportunities in a business. So They probably will fall into one of those five buckets. And then within those areas, if you look at the processes, you can start to see that now I'm looking for those seven forms of WASTE or eight forms of WASTE. And in the process of using the energy or of using the chemicals or how we process and utilize the water. And then with each of those seven forms of WASTE, they each come with an environmental impact that may be related to what you're trying to improve, or they might be something else.
Okay, so something ancillary. Okay. Mm-hmm.
As you were explaining this, Brian, it comes to mind. It's almost like the 4 P's or the 6 M's. This is just a different way, if you're doing a fishbone, to start thinking about, or mind map, to start thinking about what are some of the areas where you want to kind of make sure that none of this is happening or none of these ways are occurring.
Yeah, so if you have a lean event going on, then you could think about those five acronym of the WASTE and try to think about, do any of these apply to this part of the process, and should we be pulling that into the discussion? You know, is there something more we can capture in terms of costs to help justify what our improvements here? Or is there something that this is highlighting another bigger issue that's going on in just our efficiency of that process? So yeah, I think it's can be more useful maybe when you're not focused on the environment, but you want to try to bring those discussions into the general improvements that are going on.
Just a couple of thoughts come to mind, because basically the way I'm hearing it or seeing it, you know, because it's often difficult to get financial benefits directly from environment, but you do a project that has a environmental benefit, maybe as a side benefit, that benefit is almost its own currency in a way, if you're monitoring that sort of thing. Did you find that currency is able to be spent? You know, a lot of companies out there say we're green, and they try to attract more customers with that branding, you know, depending on what they mean by that. But has the green brand helped the company, or do they leverage that, or is it just something they know they have to do?
You know, as far as taking the benefits, yeah, I think that's part of the carbon, or not the carbon, the corporate responsibility report. So Definitely anything that comes out of events where we can improve the environment or we have an impact on one of those metrics, then we would try to share that and report that up into our end of year summary. And so that report is separate from our normal annual financial statement and annual report. So, yeah, definitely they're always looking for examples to share, and to try to show that, yep, we are keeping an eye on these things. We're trying to reduce our impact. We're trying to be good stewards and good community partners. And so that definitely helps in that respect. But I think the, you know, for a company to really I'd say, come out and say, we are truly a sustainable and very environmentally friendly company. I think they got to start to show that they're impacting their products and services. You know, it's great that they might put up solar panels and they might have a good recycling program, but if they still have a product or service that they provide that is not very eco-friendly, then it's kind of sends a different message that, you know, we're not going to change how we run our business. We're just going to do some things around the side to show people that we're trying to do a little bit. But I think the companies that are looked on most favorably, they've really tried to integrate that into what they offer to their customers and then try to separate themselves from their competition by what they actually provide versus, right. you know, buy our product because we have done some other side projects. They really, the best companies are the ones that are saying, no, this is our offering and our product is going to save you energy, or it's using recycled materials, or it has less packaging or something that you don't have to kind of sell it on the side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that selling it on the side makes it difficult. I mean, you have a, you know, one of our last companies, it was, you know, we have a recycling program. We've reduced this to satisfy, we've reduced our, you know, gross tonnage of cardboard or whatever to satisfy this, but we can't take the lead out of our solder, you know, that's still there.
Yep. Yeah. And there's, you know, we actually went through and took the, some of the chemicals out of the HumaSeal process and went to a water-based HumaSeal. And there was environmental reasons to do that. And there's safety reasons to do that. And I was involved in a project that we had to put it back in. We had to go back to the old, more toxic stuff because of it wasn't actually performing. And that was kind of really, it was very frustrating to be involved. But the experiment, you know, the DOE didn't really lie. It was, we were having problems with functionality of the product with the water-based. And so, unfortunately, the data didn't lie, and for now we've had to go back and use the older stuff. But I think as long as that's still always an option, we keep looking for other ways to solve that problem and keep working through that. That's the most important thing, that you're kind of always making progress, even if you have some setbacks. That's not like, well, that was a waste, and we let's not do that again. But what did we learn? Just like any good lean company, what did we learn, and what value did that have, and how do we go forward with this information that we obtained and use it as a something positive going forward, and not looked at as, oh, the experiment didn't do what we wanted it to, so it was a failure, so this stuff doesn't work.
Right. So, you know, Jacob, I'm recalling a very large 5S event I did that you probably heard about, where we went in and the 5S pretty much ended up costing the company a whole lot of money in a lab pack that was three trailers large. So it's hard to justify financial benefits when your project is the one that's making the money land on the books. Brian, you ever have that situation that you've seen or anything like that?
Yeah, I think there's... Are you talking about like where you got more cost than what you originally were intending, or it ended up costing more later on?
Yeah, well, basically I'm talking about, you know, they kept this inventory of obsolete chemicals that they were never using and they were hidden for that long. But once you do the event, say, oh, we're going to start saving you money now. We're going to put everything in a chemical library that we won't have to double order anymore. But first we have to get through these hundreds of thousands of hazardous waste to get there.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I know that there are certain buildings that are, you know, they can't do certain upgrades to because of asbestos, or maybe there's some old processes that were done in the past that are buried, and they'd really like to demo the building, but the cost to deal with that is actually more than just either leaving it as it is or not doing anything. So that I know that's
right.
becomes part of the decision making. But yeah, at some point you have to deal with the problem and say, all right, we're either going to bite the bullet and pay, do the expense right now. We've been pushing it off, or we've been unaware of it, or not sure how to proceed. But at some point, yeah, you want to try to take care of those things so it's not kind of lingering and hanging out there. And that's mm-hmm. that's what a lot of the transparency that a lot of companies are getting into is there's, you know, Superfund sites and someone owns those, and those sites have hazardous material and they need to be cleaned at some point or not disturbed. And they a lot of companies are either acquiring those properties through acquisitions, or they've had them and they're just not sure what to do with them. But eventually you can't just let them sit forever. So yeah, initially there may be more cost incurred to kind of deal with the old problems. I think that's fairly common to almost any kind of improvement too. It's you're going right. in and you're dealing with employee issues that have been not dealt with, and you might mm-hmm. step backwards initially, but hopefully if you have this end goal, you have to go through that point so you can actually move forward.
Yeah, it's the case of clearing your old debts. You know, that's basically what it's going to be.
Right. That's right. So I'm looking at some of these other things that you said, some differences that Lean Six Sigma overlooks, and some that caught my eye. You have one that says waste occurs away from the Gemba,
yep.
and then another one that says the data is often non-normal. Can you talk about both of those?
Sure, yeah. So the waste occurring away from the Gemba. So normally we're taught to go to where the work's being done and observe and look for the inefficiencies and talk to the people who do the work. And when you're talking about electricity or heating and cooling or lighting, those might be operated or controlled. Maybe it occurs at where the work's being done, but it's operated or it's maybe even hidden in some cases from where the actual work is. So you have to look, go into the substation room. You might have to go look at the pipes that take the water in and see if they're insulated, if there's leaks, there's condensation. So a lot of the things that the facility group might be in charge of, a lot of those things might be hidden from view. So one of the events that we put together, and we took this from, I think GE had come up with it originally, but it was an energy treasure hunt. Mm. And so it's kind of the same idea around the go and see or the Gemba walks, where we go into the building at different times, and we got people from that work area. And we would go at over the weekend and at night and during the shifts. And the goal was to observe what was going on and look for opportunities based mm-hmm. on what you see. But some of those things were not what you would normally look for. If you're walking through the office area, most people aren't looking at the windows to try to figure out, you know, if there's condensation or maybe a leak or it's not insulated well enough. So you're kind of looking around the work area, but also maybe even completely separated from that for some of those opportunities.
Okay. So, and then when you're looking at that, you also say there's some confusion on whether or not a utility usage is value added or mm-hmm. non-value added. How have you approached that situation?
Yeah. So it kind of plays a dual role when you are, you know, processing something through a machine the first time, then the electricity would be considered value added. That's maybe part mm-hmm. of the cost you've already built into that. But if it's for rework or if you leave the machine running while you go to break, I would classify that as non-value added electricity mm-hmm. usage. So depending on how it's being used, you can categorize it into value added or non-value added. So there's some confusion sometimes about, well, I need the water to clean the parts. Yes, but it should have been cleaned the step prior, so now it's considered non-value added. But as part of maybe smoothing over the part, and it's a laser water jet system, then it's a value-added use of the water. So
okay,
it plays into both buckets, so we can't just say, well, water falls under non-value added or value added. It depends on its application at that time. So certain times it's value added and other times it's non-value added. We want to go after the times when it's non-value added so that we're not worried about the electricity when it's being used. We want to stop the wasted electricity for the reworked parts, or when you're leaving it running, like leaving the oven on overnight because we don't have a timer system for it. You know, it baked the part after 8 hours, but the remaining 6 hours it was on before someone came in the morning, that's the piece that is non-value added. We want to go after that first.
So that would describe the, you know, hundreds of thousands of gallons that we put directly into the sewer over the weekend. Yes.
But maybe for cooling and keeping the work area comfortable as part of the cooling system, it's value added. But not when it's wasted when no one's there.
Right.
You are listening to E6S Methods Podcast, brought to you by E6S Industries. Join us on our website at www.e6s-methods.com. Journey through success.
Hey, Jacob, you remember when you used to work for me?
Sure.
Do you happen to remember how much money you were making back then?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah? And how much more you're making right now?
I can do the math.
And how about that development plan that you and I put together during that time?
Definitely gave me some perspective and gave me some direction on what I need to focus on. I found that useful.
So far, I have 100% promotion success rate for those people who are willing to work hard and were willing to work with me to create a customized career development plan, the E6S Pro Career Program. Three different levels: promotion and pathfinding level, which is career planning, customized improvement plans, resume refinement, and interview preparation. The next level down is targeted for those people who are, they're just looking to prepare for their next move. And because it really does pain me to see unemployed professionals, I am offering a level called Help Quick, a free one-time resume review and revision for those who are unemployed and in the Lean Six Sigma, quality, engineering, project management, or science fields. So for anybody who wants more details and information, these can be found at www.e6s-methods.com/pro-career. And if you're serious about career advancement, contact me through the website. You'll be glad you did.
I can vouch for that.
The other thing you highlighted was the non-normal data. And that kind of gets into some of the, not always at the manufacturing level, but just in general. I end up taking a class on environmental data, and a lot of the stuff like water contaminants and air emissions and some of the natural processes that you might measure out in on the river streams or in the air itself, a lot of those end up being non-normal distributions. So a lot of the training was on non-parametric analysis. And so that was a good refresher. I think I had taken a class back in college, but, you know, everything is based on, you know, especially in the Six Sigma training, it's around normal distributions, and maybe you do some transformations if you got non-normal data. But they had a lot of good techniques for dealing with using non-parametrics, doing medians tests and different ways of not transforming the data, keeping it in its current format, and just running utilizing different techniques for that. So I thought that was a good, that class for me was a really good refresher of those ideas, and actually kind of shows that we probably should be using median and ranges a little bit more than we probably do today in general. So there's a lot of, there's fewer assumptions around normality that you can use some of these techniques.
Right.
So I got a lot out of that particular class. So like some of the electricity data may not be non-normal, or some of the water usage, but I think as you get more into the nature part of it, it becomes a lot more non-normal, and you have a lot of real aberrant values that you have to deal with a little differently.
Well, yeah, well, I guess you get some of those extending tails for when you really, really messed it up.
Yeah.
And I think the trade-off for that is you just need more data. You less assumptions if you or less data if you assume normality, the perfect normal world. So, but yeah, that's really good. That's a really good point, and one that we should consider in all our projects when we're looking at them is don't forget to check for normality.
You know, specifically, is that a reason why, you know, besides a lower sample size, why would it be non-normal? I mean, I understand the nature aspect of things, but I just still a part of me just wants to disagree that it is non-normal to that an extent.
Yeah. It was a couple of years since I took the class, but I there was a kind of a rationale behind why it wasn't going to come out not normal. Maybe it's part of the sampling and how that's done, or seemed like there's fewer, like I was asking questions around constant monitoring, and that did not seem to be something that's done very often. It feels like there was a lot of, you go out to a site and you take samples of, let's say, the hazardous material and the groundwater. And that's not something where you've hooked up a meter to that and you're constantly tracking that data, like with a control chart. Because I was asking about control charting, and that did not seem to be something very commonly done. It's kind of like you go out at one time and you take a sample, and then you come back and you draw conclusions off that. And that, of course, raises some other questions in my mind. But so it might be something to do with the metering. It might be something to do right. with the properties of how you're trying to pick up particulates in a water stream, or I'll have to maybe look up some of the explanation they gave on that. But
well, yeah, I mean, when you're talking about monitoring, that's some of that's an artifact of exactly the sampling, because you're going to have lower detection limits on both of those in some manner. So if it's usually for a contaminant, if you have some sort of meter, it's saying below a certain value, and then as soon as it registers above that value, which is above zero, mm-hmm. it starts showing its distribution. And same is kind of similar for a particulate, where it's an entire sieve system that creates a non-normal situation. So Jacob, it might not be that it's non-normal actually in nature, and Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but it could be that that's all we can detect with our instruments is non-normality.
Yeah, there's definitely some stuff around, you know, that it can't read below certain values, so it just gives you a zero, or gives you a no reading or something like that. Right. Or it says it's greater than 5, and you don't know if it was 7 or 25 or 100. You just know that it's above 5. And so you have to, and there are some tricks on how to deal with those types of data. It's kind of like sensor data, where you don't really know the true number. You just know it's at least this amount, and it could be somewhere greater than that. So there was it was pretty interesting class, but I don't remember offhand exactly the non-normality piece.
Okay. So when you're coming up on these projects here, which direction do you tend to gravitate? Toward the statistical side, which is your upbringing, or the lean side,
Yeah, so I think the approach that worked really well at the last facility I worked at, where we did the projects and we had to go and see, was a combination of the top-down project, where we did electricity reduction using Six Sigma project format. So we had a DMAIC, and we went mm-hmm. through the whole analysis with that. The other piece was that go-and-see effort, where we did a bottoms-up, and where we were engaging people in the work area and trying to get there, basically trying to teach them how to see the waste and see the right. environmental opportunities that are there, so that they can share that with their coworkers and start to notice, hey, every time I walk by this equipment, it's on, or every time this machine processes, I can hear the motor churning, or it starts to rattle a little bit more, and it seems like it's working overtime, and that might be a sign that it's going to break down soon. You're just trying to engage a lot more people into that process. So I like the statistics part of it. I love the data. I try not to gravitate to it, too much to it, unless it's, you know, appropriate. But in general, I think starting off, I think lean is much more broader and more encompassing to begin with. So I like that part of it, that you're trying to engage people and teach them how to solve their own problems and learn how to make things run smoother and see the waste. So I like that part about lean as well. For these types of things, I think it depends on the situation, but if it's not overly complex and you're trying to change behaviors, I definitely would kind of lean more towards a lean approach, where I do maybe an event, or we would have some kind of go and see, or we would just get the right people together and just start engaging them in the discussion. Where it's something more technical and more complex, then I like going down the data path and trying to show statistically what we can, where our usage is coming from, and where there's some opportunities, and where there's spikes in the data, and what we can go dig mm-hmm. into on those. So it depends a little bit on the intent, but overall, I think lean seems to be hits and touches more people, or you have the opportunity to touch more people and get them involved in the problem solving process.
And you actually recommend that if a company doesn't have a sustainability program, that they should start with a lean program first?
Yeah, just because, you know, by default, by becoming more lean, by reducing defects, by taking and eliminating waste, you are going to get some environmental gains without even really trying. And then you can start to leverage that and bring in your support team, bring in your facilities into your events, your ESNH people, get them at least on call or at the report outs of the events. So they can at least ask those questions and maybe avoid some problems. Like, hey, you can't move that equipment because I have to go get a new permit and that's going to take 3 weeks. But maybe we could bring them in during the event, the person who's doing the approval of it. And then when we go to get the approval, it might shorten that time down. So there's some things we can do to work around some of those constraints, but sometimes we don't know about it if we don't have the right people on board. So that's why I recommend that maybe starting with lean, but then if you have facilities and you have ESNH or somebody who has that role, get them engaged on any of your events, because you never know when they're going to be able to provide some really good value or help out. And either help identify the opportunities or capture the benefits that you're going to get on the environmental side, or avoid running into a problem later on that now we can't finish the move because we ran into this issue, or something happened and now we got fined because we exceeded a limit because we didn't realize what we changed up.
Right. Hey, Jacob, you got anything else on you want to ask about?
Yeah, I don't have anything as a question, but I did, you know, earlier on, Brian, you mentioned that, you know, one of the best resources you have for this is the EPA lean section. And I have to say, it's the first time I've ever heard anybody reference a governmental or a federal agency that has a program that is actually very informative and is actually being used for the right reasons. So it's definitely a shocker. You know, I think Aaron and I have talked about different areas in the government where they can use a lot of lean and efficiency improvements. But this is the first one I've heard about, and I'm definitely curious and going to read a little bit more and see what they have.
Yeah, they actually have a lean in the government piece. And so it's specific not to environment, but just government in general. And it just talks about lean techniques and approaches you can use to deal with some of those. Because there's a very strong overlap with, you know, air permitting inefficiency and the lead time and how long that takes, and applying lean concepts to that. So the EPA by default naturally just kind of spread out into dealing with just general government things that go on that are not lean with, it doesn't take much discussion to come up with a laundry list of things that don't run very efficiently, but that was kind of additional content that's out there. There's a section on lean in the government itself. And there's been a couple of cities and states that have really taken this and embraced it. City of Fort Wayne, Indiana, I think, has a Six Sigma program. Tyler, Texas, Irving, Texas have pretty strong Lean Six Sigma programs. State of Washington, just north of Portland here, they get a lot of influence from Boeing and other companies up there. And they've got like an annual conference, and they have a whole department, and they do training. And their website has a lot of good videos from their conferences on efficiencies and lean tools and stuff. So slowly it's starting to be adopted. But again, those toolkits were made over 10 years ago, I think. And basically they had a good rollout initially, and they got some case studies, and then, you know, they get off track and looking at other initiatives. And I kind of feel like I want to try to help keep that going and keep promoting those items, because they're very valuable. And it's a great starting point. They're nice, you know, easy to digest. They're not black belt level stuff. It's anyone can kind of read through them and really get some good value out of it. So
you talked about wanting to keep that going, and you do yourself have a website and a blog, and some, you do some curating of materials. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I was trying to put together just as I was doing some research, I'm really looking for good examples of not just environmental improvements, but where there was a lean tool or Six Sigma tool applied. So I'm really trying to find a lot of good examples out there for people to look at and see, all right, here's, you know, like the value stream map, and here's a value stream map where they, you know, added water to the data box and added it to the baseline or the timeline piece. Here's a 5S where they were able to not only clean up the truck, but it reduced the weight. And so there's a transportation and fuel savings because there's less stuff and less tools in the trucks themselves. So there's quite a few different examples I try to pull together. Any articles around Lean and Six Sigma and the environment. I put on a website and I write just articles for that when I think of stuff or projects I work on. It's leansixsigmaenvironment.org. And so I'm always looking for if anyone has some projects they've worked on or experiences where they've applied these techniques. I think the more examples and case studies that are out there, people can resonate with, and then they can see how they can try it out and hopefully get some benefit. So,
okay. So if any of the listeners have a case study that they want to share with you, how would they contact you to share that with you?
They can either go to that website and just contact me through the form, or I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest thing for people to get a hold of me and just connect with me there, and then mention that you heard of me on the podcast, and then we can start to exchange some. I'm looking for pictures and my PowerPoint presentations or report outs, things like that, that they're willing to share. Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Okay, so Brian, we're going to start wrapping it up. Is there anything that you want to share that we haven't yet talked about?
No, I think we covered quite a bit. I think the last comment I'll make is there's a lot of evidence coming through now that companies that spend a lot of their time balancing out those three areas and really looking at how do they reduce their impact on the environment. And by default, you know, it kind of works the other way around. I talked about how being lean will get environmental impacts, but also by focusing on environmental wastes or materials that are being used and thrown away, if you can work on those, you can gain some efficiencies in your process as well. For example, the other day I was looking at a process and we're noticing how much time is being spent unpackaging items. So not only is there a bunch of bubble wrap and cost that goes with that, but the time that they're cutting it open and ripping it apart and pulling parts out of bags, and that if you can figure out a way to make that process more efficient, you're saving time, right, and the business is succeeding there. So either approach can gain the business some success, regardless of kind of what the intent is going into it, whether you're just trying to do the right thing or you're actually trying to make the business run better. It does fit nicely into having a positive impact on the environment.
Yeah, anywhere where you can eliminate, especially that interim packaging. I've had similar situations. Yep.
So that's the only other thing is either option can kind of get you in the same boat where you're actually helping the business succeed. And if you do that, your efforts will get supported. If you're trying to do something off the path, you'll have a much harder time getting those initiatives approved and supported.
So do you have any last final, say, calls to action for anybody listening to this of how they can also consider the environment when they're looking at their improvements?
Yeah, I think if there is one action, I would say pull in your ESNH or facility team members or support team into any Lean or Six Sigma projects you have going on, and start to engage them upfront in the business case and what you're trying to accomplish. And then if they can participate in the event or in the project, great. If they're just on call or as kind of a involved in the report outs or the monthly updates, then at least they're kind of engaged. And then help them run their own events, and because they already have probably scorecard and metrics they're trying to achieve that might align well. So just make sure there's a strong connection with those three departments.
Okay. Hey, Jacob, you got anything else?
No, that's it. This is great.
Okay, so we're going to say goodbye to our listeners now. And Brian, you just hang on, and we'll start to wrap this up, okay? All right. So, hey, thanks everybody for listening, and do get in touch with Brian. Go to his website, LeanSixSigmaEnvironment.org, and submit your case studies and get in touch with Brian on LinkedIn. And if you are in Atlanta on October 2nd, come on out to the Industrial Institute for Industrial Engineers 2015 Engineering Lean Six Sigma Conference in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, if you can't be there on the 2nd and you can only be there on the 1st, then come check me out there. Okay, so, hey, thanks again, Brian, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening to episode 93 of the eSuccess Methods Podcast. Remember to check out Brian's work at LeanSixSigmaEnvironment.org. If you would like to be a guest on the podcast, contact us through our website. Join our mailing list. Subscribe to past and future episodes on iTunes or stream us on demand with Stitcher Radio. Don't forget to leave a review and share us with a friend. Find outlines and graphics for all shows and more at www.e6s-methods.com. Journey through success.